my dad showing me play a video game on his Apple IIe. He had a Star Trek game.
That is Kevin Portman, a Salesforce architect over at Chief. I'm Josh Burke, your host of the Salesforce Developer Podcast. And here in the podcast, you'll hear stories and insights from developers for developers. Today, we bring back Kevin into the studio to talk about one of his projects, Apex Kit, which is kind of a highly opinionated library, shall we say, for a lot of the stuff that you need to do with Apex. But we're going to continue on right there where we left off with his early years about that Apple IIe game.
And it had this, like, it was a little bit like, you know, You Shrunk My Battleship, mm-hmm. where there was a field of green text on the black screen, and you had little Ks for Klingon ships, and you had the E for the Enterprise, and you had to, like, navigate around the screen and find the Klingons, and then you might, well, in my case, I died quite a lot.
I vaguely remember that. Yeah, it was like a combination of, like, Minesweeper and Battleship or something like that.
Yeah.
Nice. Was computing something you always wanted to get into?
No. When I was a kid, I did dance.
Okay.
I was a ballet and jazz dancer. Right. And then I shattered my left hip when I was 14. And it turns out in Kansas, even if you're in the hospital, the state says you still have to go to school.
Oh.
And so the hospital room school was to go down the hall in my wheelchair and futz around on an Apple IIe. Yeah. And so I started learning how to write BASIC, Apple BASIC.
Gotcha. When did you first get introduced to Salesforce?
Oh, let's see. Probably December of 2008, January 2009, somewhere in there. I was working at a email marketing company. I'm sorry. And they decided that they needed to move away from sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, earlier that week, we had run out of space on the database server, and the DBA had just deleted all the attachments.
Oh,
sugar. And then they were like, you know, maybe we should do something in the cloud.
Oh.
And so, yeah, we switched to Salesforce in 6 weeks, I think. And I was part of the team that helped do that.
Gotcha. You know, I have nothing against sugar, but I will use an old joke. A friend of mine who is a sales guy at Model Metrics used to call sugar one of the best pre-sales tools he ever had. So, yeah, I don't think you're alone in that particular transition. How would you describe your current job?
My current job, I'm a Salesforce architect / staff level engineer, wrangling all sorts of fun things here at Chief.
How many hats do you think you have right now?
More than I have heads. I'll put it that way. Nice. I haven't even, you know, I should stop and think about that and count them up. You know, today I've been playing release manager.
Nice.
And yesterday was all CI stuff. So,
yeah. Nice. Now, in between last time we spoke and your current role, I just noticed this on LinkedIn. So I have to ask, you worked on a, and I think I'm quoting here, a multilingual weight calculator for FedEx?
Yeah. Yeah. So the timing on that's off. I did that a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
But when you ship something, there's the idea you have dimensional weight, and dimensional weight doesn't make any sense as a sentence, but
right.
The idea is that sometimes the dimensions of the object you're shipping are more important than the weight of the item you're shipping. And so they take the height, width, and depth of the packaged box, and they come, there's a calculation to determine its dimensional weight. It's an algorithm. I wrote a bit of code to do that on, it was, I-18 end for all of the various German subsidiaries, or not German subsidiaries, EU subsidiaries, EU localities, I think is the right way to say it. Yeah.
Nice.
That was a long time ago.
Gotcha. Well, more relevant, you've also released Apex Kit, correct? That's a singular, Apex Kit?
Yeah, Apex Kit.
And how does this involve woodworking?
So, during the pandemic, everyone either adopted a pet or picked up a new hobby.
Right.
I picked up woodworking. My quasi-therapist was like, you need a hobby that will force you to slow down. And the only way I can think that would cause, the only thing that she said she could think that would cause Kevin to slow down was something that might cost me my fingers. And so her suggestion was woodworking. And I've always enjoyed woodworking and that sort of stuff. So I picked up woodworking and I get to use all sorts of saws. And if you've never done woodworking, you may not know this, but woodworking equipment is, it's on the expensive side. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, oh, I'm going to pick up a new hobby type level thing. So I have a lot of really old vintage equipment, which is great because it's indestructible, outlive me. It also has zero safety features.
Nice. Okay.
So I definitely have to slow down and think through things.
Gotcha.
But as I was picking up woodworking and I'm reading and I'm watching YouTube videos and I'm talking to other people, and I joined a Central Indiana Woodworkers Guild, which is a, you know, a bunch of people that like to make things out of wood.
Nice.
And I joined them and I'm learning all this stuff from them. I learned that most of the time I'm, you know, you think about a hobby like, oh, I'm going to go paint something. And then you sit down and you start painting.
Right.
Or you sit down, you know, I'm going to learn to play the piano. And so you sit down and you start hitting keys. In woodworking, it's not that.
Yeah.
In woodworking, you end up making things to make the thing that you want to make, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But a lot of woodworking requires precise angles and accurate cuts. And the only way to get, for instance, four table legs that are exactly the same size is to make a jig. And the idea of a jig is that you have some thing that you've built. Sometimes you can buy them, but most of the time you build them. Mm-hmm. And these jigs help you make repeatable, accurate, precise cuts.
Gotcha.
So, you know, imagine something that, you know, you can put the piece of wood into and it will always cut that piece of wood at 31 and 16 or 11 16ths inches long.
Nice.
Or whatever the measurement is. And as I'm building these jigs to do different things. And I remember I was sitting there, I was building a crosscut sled with a stop block, which is a very fancy way of saying I wanted to be able to cut something at 31 inches and 11 16ths, but do it 500 times perfectly accurately.
Got it.
And I build this jig and I think, you know, so much of what I do in software could really benefit from this same idea. Mm-hmm. So I started putting together a list in my head of jigs, software jigs, which are, you know, a tool or a framework that helps you do something repeatably and accurately, and in software's case, securely and safely without accidentally. These are things that everyone has to do sooner or later, but we don't, it's really easy to get wrong.
Right.
Right. So we have various jigs in here that help you do different things, but they help you do it safely and securely. And because you can just pick them up and use them, you don't have to reinvent the wheel.
So first of all, I love that analogy because it's like it's not wood carving, right? You're not taking a block of wood and then carving away everything that doesn't look like an elephant. You're left with an elephant. It's like a table has four legs. You have to figure out how to build the one leg, do that three times, and then figure out how to put the top on and make sure everything's like fitting together. It also sounds like a slightly more abstracted way of thinking about like a utility lib or a framework. How does the interoperability work with this library? Like, are they independent structures? Do they work with each other? A little bit of both?
A little bit of both. Okay. So there's different pieces to it. And the idea is that there are different jigs in your shop to use. So for instance, there's a query library, and that query library also uses a safety and security library called Safely. And you can use Safely independently of the query library, but if you adopt the query library, you automatically get to use Safely.
Gotcha. Because Safely works at like the DML level, right? And so then if you're using the query language, it's pulling in Safely so that it knows that it's doing the DMLs correctly.
Yeah. And then it's like, this is a good example. Safely is a jig to help you do any kind of DML in a way that prevents CRUD and FLS leaking.
Got it.
Which is to say, it's, I guess, in a more common way of saying, it's going to enforce CRUD and FLS on all the DML you do through Safe.
Got it. What's it like to have things like, do you find yourself not competing, but catching up with like security updates as they come through Apex when it comes to things like user mode and stuff like that?
Yeah. So that's a great question. It's currently not updated to use user mode. Okay. That's in the works. So the way it's currently written, that particular instance uses technology, the security decision object that goes back probably 2 years at this point. But when we get into user mode stuff, that's even more precise. And so, you know, that's coming. And yeah, there's a sense in which jigs are never done. You're always going to be adjusting them.
Right.
And whether that's because there's something new or because like when I make a jig, that jig fits my particular saw. Mm-hmm. I can't just let my neighbor borrow that because he has a different kind of saw. It won't fit. So, you know, making them, keeping them up to date is a little bit of a, it's a challenge, but it's also the fun bit because it keeps me up to date on all the,
right.
the good stuff.
And it's just, I think it's a challenge that's well known to Apex developers. Three releases a year. We're always trying to, you know, keep up. I think back in my model metrics days, I was always like, if you're using the same code you were doing 3 months ago, you're probably doing it wrong. Like constantly go back and reevaluate because what you're doing in 10 lines might be just one these days.
Well, I'm going to challenge you on that because yep. the whole idea of something like Safely is that it's that jig. Then if you've written code to utilize Safely, mm-hmm. if I go in and update Safely to use user mode,
you're not breaking
that API hasn't changed.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So nice.
You know, I've made it better. You reap the benefits of that, but you don't necessarily have to update your code.
Got it. No, good point. Before we get into more of the specifics, I kind of want to call out that you also back at Salesforce released a project called Apex Recipes. Now, what's the connection mm-hmm. and the distinction between that project and this one? Because it feels very similar and yet very different at the same time.
So Apex Recipes started off life as any of the recipes projects do, an example code that teach you how to do things. And the code you write to teach someone how to do something is vastly different than the code you write to actually do something in production.
Sure.
Right? So there are parts of Apex Recipes that do not necessarily reflect the best security practices in terms of how to query things or, you know, with security enforced, that sort of thing. But they're also there to illustrate what you can do, not necessarily what you should do. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes you have to know what you can do before you really understand what you should do.
Right.
So Apex Recipes is sort of the Apex Kit kind of grew out of Apex Recipes.
Okay.
It's sort of the it's the spit and polish on the learning repo mm-hmm. to make something that you could actually use in production.
Got it. Well, and if I remember some of our discussions back in like the early planning phases of Apex Recipes, the goal was to be slightly opinionated. Like, don't be opinionated until you kind of have to be opinionated and then offer that in because it's going to make for more complete code. Is it fair to say that Apex Recipes is like the lightly opinionated, but Apex Kit is very strongly opinionated? This is Kevin Poorman's, this is how you believe this should be done and put into production.
Yeah. So about 5 years ago, there's this guy named David Heinemeier Hansen. He's the progenitor of Rails, the framework mm-hmm. for Ruby. Mm-hmm. And he gave a Ruby or a RailsConf keynote where he talked about how Rails is omakase. And omakase is a Japanese word that means, I don't really know what it means, but the the connotation translation is that you trust the author, or in the case of omakase, it actually comes out of sushi culture. Mm-hmm. And if you walk into a sushi restaurant mm-hmm. in Japan and you say, omakase to the sushi chef, mm-hmm. you're making sort of a Faustian bargain or a social contract with the sushi chef that you trust them to give you their very best.
Yeah.
And you're not going to worry about ordering anything. They're just going to bring your food until they have to wheel you out.
Right.
And David's idea there is that Rails is omakase, meaning that you have to trust the Rails core team and developers that they are going to help you build your stuff correctly, with the idea of convention over configuration. That's the whole Rails magic. Mm-hmm. So I like to say that Apex Kit is omakase. You know, you don't have to eat everything that's delivered to you. So if you only want to use Safely, by all means, but the whole Apex Kit itself is very opinionated as to how you should do things.
Gotcha. Now, digging into some of the details, I want to talk about one that I know you've worked on actually for some time, so it's not surprising to see it in this library. Apex promises, to level set for the novices, what exactly are, what's a promise structure in code?
Yeah, so promises, as far as I'm aware, the whole idea of a promise originated in JavaScript.
I think that's right. That's my belief as well. I'll share that at least, yeah.
Yeah, so at least that's where I came across it. I'll put it that way. So promises in JavaScript are a data structure and or a technique that allows you to call a method that returns the promise of an eventual value, which is a $10 way of saying it's going to do something asynchronously and return it to you at a future date.
Right.
In the JavaScript world, this has largely been replaced, or not replaced with, it's been enhanced to do async await. Mm-hmm. So if you're familiar with async await, async await in JavaScript works by creating a promise and returning the promise. And so the idea here is that with a promise structure, You're going to say, hey, I need to go run this work. It's going to be asynchronous. I don't know when it's going to complete. Mm-hmm. And then it allows you to attach work to be done when that work completes.
Yeah.
So I can say, go do A, and whenever it's finished, go do B.
And coming from a pre-premise world, it's like, I think people should like appreciate what that's replacing, which was essentially a series of functions with inputs waiting on each other sort of thing, and which worked. And I'm going to dig into this a little bit here in a second. And I'm kind of guessing the behind the scenes functionality may not even be all that different, but it's really hard to read. Like you almost need to know the map, right? To know from this function, we're going to this function, then from this function, we're going to this function. And God forbid if there's an if else in there somewhere.
Right.
What's it like to port something like that into Apex? Because my first thought would be that's a very, it's almost like a system level like functionality. But what was the reference that you're using to build something like that anew into Apex?
So I thought about it long and hard, and the original need for this arose. I was working with a nonprofit to help them do some geospatial calculations in Apex, and that involved callouts to various APIs. Mm-hmm. And at the time, you could only make, I think, 10 callouts per transaction.
Right.
HTTP callouts. And so I had to find a way to break these up because these were complex streams of API queries. And I started looking at how promises worked in the JavaScript world. And at the time, this is so far back, that promises weren't an official part of the JavaScript language.
Gotcha.
They were implemented in sort of NPM libraries. And the one I looked at was, I think it was called Bluebird.
Bluebird. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. And I just started looking at how they did it. And it's hard because JavaScript and Apex are radically different languages. Right. And I don't have the system level access that the JavaScript does.
Right.
But I looked at, you know, fundamentally what I needed to be able to do was run some asynchronous code. And Apex at the time had at future methods. Mm-hmm. And it also had, this is right after queuables was introduced.
Right.
And so I'm like, okay, this brand new thing called queuables. And I had to keep track of a list of queuables because it almost goes without saying that if you're using a promise, you have multiple things in sort of a promise chain. Mm-hmm. You're going to do A and then B and then C and then D. And I wanted to add on to that some things that Bluebird had, which was not only to run asynchronous work and to keep track of that asynchronous work, but also to have error control.
Got it.
So I wanted to be able to say, oh, this failed. What do we do now? And so I looked at how could I do those two things in Apex? And what came to mind was I could use queuables to do the asynchronous work. And I could, because queuables can enqueue one more queuable, I could, you know, write the code in such a way that I could pass a list of queuable objects down the chain so that, you know, when the next queuable started up, it just needed to take the queuable off the list and execute that. Mm-hmm. And so the promise framework in JavaScript looks like in Apex is it's kind of tail recursion. Every time the queuable ends, it says, hey, do I have any more in the list? Mm-hmm. And then it executes the next queuable.
Gotcha.
And then, so like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, they came out with finalizers, and it's been rewritten to use finalizers, so it's even a little bit more composable.
Got it. A couple of different ways I can follow up on that, but I'm gonna go in this direction. Is I thought this was an interesting thing to put into an opinionated library like this. That what you're describing, and we're gonna be a little recursive here, but what you're describing is kind of like a polyfill, right? Like would you define it? So well, let me just throw that back at you. How would you define a polyfill?
So I'm going to answer that question, but first I want to apologize to Daniel and Chris because I'm about to poke them in the eye.
Okay.
A polyfill to me is functions that should be written and supported and maintained by Salesforce as part of the Apex language, but are not.
Right. Well, right. I mean, they only have so much time on the planet. Like that's their job right now is figuring out how to to bridge that gap, right? So this gap, so the reason, one of the reasons I really wanted to focus on this was in my conversation with Greg Whitworth. We go into great length about the how the concept of a polyfill is basically something that should eventually become obsolete because it is what you're describing, right? It's something, it's like saying, hey, I've seen your platform. I really think it should have this. Kind of like Bluebird, it doesn't. So we're going to write that until you catch up with it, and then we can throw the whole thing out. So I don't think any, you know,
exactly.
Maybe that might be more of a poke in the shoulder than the eyeball. But what?
No, that's fair.
Like, how does that work within Apex Kit? Like, what does Apex Kit does to help me create a shim like that?
I'm not sure I followed your question.
So what portion of polyfills are supported by Apex Kit? Maybe a different way of putting it.
There's an entire polyfills class in Apex Kit.
Got it.
It contains, I was talking at a user group meeting last night, and I talked about how whenever you go through the process of like splitting your code base into various packages, inevitably you end up with the package titled everything we don't know where else to put.
Right. You start with everything in the miscellaneous drawer, and then the miscellaneous drawers get smaller, but it's still there.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's still there. Yeah. No one's going to get it. Yeah. Get rid of it. And so I have a polyfills class in Apex Kit, and it contains things that it's a little bit of I don't know where else to put it. And also things that really should exist at the Apex level rather than something that is coded. And it's everything from, you know, give me take an instance and give me back its class name.
Got it.
To give me the type based on a class name.
Right.
And that sort of stuff can be done in Apex. It's just not a one-liner.
Right. Right. And it's also the kind of stuff that is handy to know isn't.
Yeah.
Like that class might just be a handy reference guide to be like, you don't have to spend 3 hours digging through the documentation to figure out what the class name is because the class name doesn't exist. Here's one for you.
Yeah, or like I have a need to be able to generate a stack trace,
yeah,
and not on an exception. So there's an exception in here called guaranteed not to exist exception, and it's an exception that can only ever be thrown by the ability when you ask for a stack trace.
Got it.
And so you can get a stack trace there.
Nice, yeah. Nice. Now changing course a little bit. Back to that idea of like a list of queueable objects that kind of get ticked off, because I believe this is similar but different. Tell me a little bit about how Ouroboros works. And I think I'm saying that name right. Is that right? Ouroboros?
Yeah. Can I start off with the premise that naming things is hard?
Naming things is hard. It's true.
Ouroboros it's a famous symbol, and I don't really know where it's from. But if you were to Google Ouroboros, you'll see this picture, and it's a picture of a snake eating its tail. And the idea is, you know, depending on which it's because it's from multiple cultures. And if you look around, it's the idea of never ending or rebirth or, you know, the whole idea that, you know, this thing you can't find at the beginning or an end.
Right.
Ouroboros is a riff on promises, but instead of having a finite set of elements in the list, Ouroboros will re-enqueue itself.
Okay.
And so these both promises and Ouroboros are implemented as abstract classes. So you're going to write your own Ouroboros implementing class.
Got it.
And it's going to be re-enqueued to do some work. And when that work is done asynchronously, it'll evaluate whether or not it needs to re-enqueue itself. Mm-hmm. And if it needs to, it'll re-enqueue itself. And the idea here is this is the answer to how do you eat an elephant? And you do it one bite at a time.
Got it.
Right. You know, so if you have to, and this came up when I was helping somebody, they wanted to write something, they needed to do something to iterate it over 3 million contacts. Mm-hmm. And you could use a batch job. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what are some other options? And we came up with this where we're going to take a chunk of 200 contacts, do something to them, and then say, okay, we're done. And then we're going to say, oh, we're not done. We still have 2 million, you know, whatever to go through and re-enqueue itself to do it.
What does that look like in production? Like two questions comes to mind with that. One is how long does it take to eat that particular elephant? And then the second one is what happens when something goes wrong on contact 1,300,000? You know, it's like halfway between a batch of that size. Like what happens if something throws a wrench in the system?
Well, because they're all done in batches as discrete transactions, if an exception occurs, it depends on how you've written it to start with. But in theory, if you've written it perfectly badly, it would just destroy that transaction and it could get kind of caught in the wayside.
Okay.
So there's a sense in which this is a jig that is, I should probably polish that jig a little bit. now that you mention it.
Okay.
But, you know, in practice, I mean, so this was written with a very specific use case in mind where they needed to deal with. So if you're not familiar with the concept of data skew is where you have a relatively small group of parent objects with an outsized number of child objects associated.
Okay.
So imagine if you've got 10 accounts, but you've got 3 million contacts.
Got it.
Right. And we need to be able to update those contacts or those accounts without hitting data skew limits in the lovely unable to lock row for update error. And so the idea here is you can set a very small size for your execution context and bite through them. And it's going to take a long time, but this allows you to correct that data skew. So you can move away from 10 accounts owning 3 million contacts to a more balanced 1.5 million accounts with 3 million contacts.
Got it.
That's why this is written.
And so you're kind of trading time and raw performance power for flexibility and the ability to basically say, I don't really care how large this data set is. It's just, it's going to get done whenever it gets done.
Exactly. Exactly. And the other, the other use case that exists for it is back in the, if you remember back in the DOS days, you had terminal stay resident
programs. Yes.
And so you can write one of these. Yeah. It'll sit there and just keep itself enqueued and keep running, waiting for something that needs to do in the background.
And when we describe it as slow, it's slow compared to other things, but like how long does it take to get through 3 million records?
Oh, I think it took like 6 days.
Okay. Which, you know, is not like press it and get it done. But if you're not spending any time in those 6 days and it just gets done in the next 6 days, then that's doing pretty darn good.
Yeah. And if you've got a problem with like data skew where you can't just go and, I mean, your other option is to do an extract update in Excel and re-upload.
Right.
Right. Which of those do you really want to do? Which one's going to be safer or less risky?
Right. And my brain can wrap around this a lot easier because I'm not worrying about the 3 million. I'm worried about the code that I want to do per 200 and some, or something like that. And so it kind of, my neurodivergent brain doesn't want to think about how to handle data size that much, but I do want to think about like the functionality that I want to apply against it. So I like the trade-off. Speaking of strange words, what's Acquidity?
That one's not on me.
That one's not on you.
Quiddity came out of the minds of the Apex team at Salesforce. As I understand it, Quiddity is a Sanskrit word that means the essence of a thing. Mm-hmm. And Quiddity is a enum in Apex on the request object. So given any Apex transaction, you can ask for the request, and then you can ask it for its Quiddity, and it will tell you the execution context of that transaction. And there's probably 20, 25 Quiddities in the enum. And they range from Aura enabled to testing to testing in parallel or doing testing during deployment. And so you can think of all the various possible ways that Apex could be executed. Mm-hmm. You're going to see all of those reflected in the Quiddity. So there's execute anonymous or, you know, custom Apex endpoints. All that sort of stuff.
Got it. And this is this jig is a wrapper class around that.
Yeah, it's a way of so you can do a lot with Quiddity, but one of the things that I think is most useful for it is to use Quiddity as a gating function to prevent code from being run that you know is potentially unsafe if there's user input.
Got it.
So imagine if you use Quiddity guard to say this can only run in triggers, or this can only run in an Aura enabled, or this can't run in Aura enabled. Mm-hmm. Then you can turn around and you can say, listen, there's no way for SQL injection to occur here because I'm not allowing this to run in a Quiddity where there's any user interaction.
Got it. Interesting. Now, I'm going to confess, until I started reviewing your repo again, I had not heard of the concept of a ULID. What is a ULID and how does it compare to our old friend, the UUID?
So the ULID is a somewhat more modern take on a universally unique identifier.
Okay.
So it's like a UUID in that it's an identifier and that it is universally unique. It's different from a UUID in its format.
Okay.
And the big difference is that it is lexicographically sortable, which is, again, it's a $10 word for the idea that you can alphabetize it.
Gotcha. My brain was catching up on that.
Right. Right. So you can generate a UUID. And in fact, there's an Apex Kit method for generating a UUID. And that's going to give you a perfectly random string, mm-hmm. whereas a ULID is going to give you a random string that starts with an encoded date. And because of that, you know what order they were created in. So
got it.
You'll never get two ULIDs that are the same, but as you create new ones, they will auto increment up, for lack of a better term.
Got it. So it's almost like the concept of like a primary or foreign key and a UUID together. In what's a solid use case for that? Like, where is a ULID going to kind of save your bacon?
So let me back up.
Yeah.
There's a new version of UUID, the classic version. Yeah. The one that everyone sort of uses now is UUID V3.
Okay.
UUID V4 is lexicographically sortable.
Okay.
But it's also not sort of, doesn't have anywhere near the adoption of a UUID.
Okay.
The idea behind a ULID is if you want to be able to generate a unique ID to share between systems, but you also want to be able to sort the sequence of those IDs or events that are tied to those IDs independent of the other system, you can use this to say, okay, I know that this one happened before this one.
Gotcha. Without having to do like checking for modified date or created date or anything like that.
Right. One of the things that I find oddly strange about the platform is that there's not an ID service that mm-hmm. users or the developers can tap into mm-hmm. and say, just give me an ID. So this serves that need for us. We can say, hey, I need an ID. It's got to be URL safe. It's got to be sortable. And it's got to be, you know, guaranteed unique here so that I can share this and this data mm-hmm. between multiple external systems.
Got it.
And
have it sorted the same way.
And have it sorted the same way.
Got it.
Yeah.
Now, in a 30 to 40 minute interview, I don't want to diminish the scope of Apex Kit. I was kind of digging into some of the stuff that I think was particularly nerdy and cool. But you also have logging jigs, you have a test factory jig, you've got a mock jig, you have the boilerplate stuff that people would want to work with as well. Is there any one of those that you want to kind of give a shout out to?
Two that come to mind. Okay. One is feature flags.
Okay.
So I'm a huge fan of feature flags. If you've ever seen an ad for LaunchDarkly or some of these other companies that do it, there's also an open source, I think it's an Apache project. I don't remember what it's called. But the idea is behind a feature flag is that you put, you create this thing that says only if this thing is true or a user has this flag assigned to it, can they access this functionality.
Okay.
And the idea here is you want to be able to turn something on or off at three levels. Mm-hmm. You want to be able to turn it off universally for the whole org. You want to be able to turn it on or off for a particular user. Mm-hmm. And you want to be able to turn it on or off for a particular permission or permission set.
Got it.
Right. And the idea here is you can use this feature flag jig in order to have your code say, listen, I've deployed a feature, but I don't want to turn it on until Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Or I want to disable this trigger. Mm-hmm. So we're going to disable the feature flag for that trigger.
Got it. Nice. And this feels particularly relevant for a platform like Salesforce, where you have, you know, stuff in production that we might want to have to turn off so that it's not breaking everything else. But also we just have such a myriad of user permissions and org permissions and enterprise, you know, additions and all those kind of, you know, like what can you do changes from one org shape to another? So instead of writing one really clunky if statement, you can just use this.
Yeah. And the feature flag jig is actually written to also work with the conditional visibility within Flexi pages.
Huh, nice.
So, you know, pull that in there and turn on or off features that way as well.
Got it. So not just a like, grand don't do this class thing, but possibly even just don't show this portion of a Lightning Web component or something.
Exactly.
Nice. What was the second one?
The other one that I'm a big fan of is the REST library.
Nice.
So one of the things that almost every org has somewhere deep yep. buried in its bowels is the call out to an API.
Yep.
And when I first started doing this, I one of the things I loved about Salesforce was you can make a HTTP call out in like five lines of code.
Mm-hmm.
And the older I get, the more I realize that I really don't want to use just five lines of code to make an HTTP call out.
Exactly.
And the other thing I picked up on over the years was that if you are interacting with an entire API, you don't want to just write a bunch of methods to make one call.
Right.
You want to abstract away some of the boilerplate. You're always going to set the same headers. You're going to worry about authentication, all that sort of stuff. You want at a different level than, okay, go hit the endpoint A. Mm-hmm. And so REST library has a helper class, a syntactic sugar class that's going to get you to say, okay, create this and go make this post call. And it'll abstract all the regular stuff around a post call for you. Take the body, take the headers, whatever, do it for you. But it also has the ability for you to write a custom class that extends the REST library for a particular API. And that allows you to set, named credential for everything in that class, the headers for everything in that class. And then your class can be like, okay, I want to go and get, go get the ID or go get the cases or whatever it is that your external API you need to do rather than go make a post call to get this. And so your API can be more descriptive and more, elegant. I'm gonna say elegant. I mean, this is my opinion on it, so it's more elegant.
And that's our show. Now, before we go, knowing that Kevin is a fan of woodworking, I was asking him, what's he working on?
Yeah, so I've been working in the wood shop on Christmas presents for Christmas 22.
Aww.
Which is saying a little behind. I've been making salt cellars. So nice. If you're a foodie, a salt cellar is a little, in this case, wood dish with a lid that swings side to side that holds salt, and you put it next to your stove, and then you can cover it so that your cat doesn't sit there and lick your salt all day. But then when you're cooking, you can just swing it open, grab a pinch of salt, and drop it in your pan. I'm making some of those for Christmas gifts.
Gotcha. I love it. I feel like that you just maybe also told us the inspiration for the invention. I want to thank Kevin for the great conversation and information. As always, I want to thank you for listening. Now, if you want to learn more about this show, head on over to developer.salesforce.com/podcast, where you can hear old episodes, see the show notes, and have links to your favorite podcast service. Thanks again, everybody, and I'll talk to you next week.